सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय ॐ असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो
Well, from my point of view, good early afternoon. I know it's many different times in many different places. I'm really delighted to be here with you. And I'm going to start with a meditation because Vidya actually wrote in a question asking if I would give the instructions on the Talu Chakra and Ajna Chakra practice slowly and precisely. So I'm going to do that. And at some point, we'll just open to questions about that practice if you want to ask, and to all other practices. So this is going to take a couple of minutes. So you can find a posture. Feel yourself very much grounded. And we'll start by doing three deep diaphragmatic breaths. So letting the breath come in, pulled by the diaphragm, and as a result, the abdomen somewhat puffs out. And then on the exhalation, the abdomen draws in, and keep it drawn in so that you expel as much of the air as you can. Inhale. And exhale. Inhale. And exhale. and begin to bring your attention to the soft palate. And remember, the instruction here is that you can curl your tongue back as if you were practicing Khechari Mudra, which in fact you kind of are, just so that you can find the soft palate, find it with your tongue, the tip of your tongue, just that place where the hard palate segues into the soft palate. And you might want to hold your tongue there for a couple of seconds. And now take a couple of inhalations while focusing on the soft palate. It's like you're joining your attention to the soft palate, and in this way, attracting the breath towards that region. And exhale. Again, feeling the energy around the soft palate. So let's just do this a couple of times. Now, for those of you who are comfortable with this, we'll practice the Pratyahara breath, which is a forceful, rapid inhalation, exhalation, a pumping breath, as in the Kapalabhati. And again, keeping your attention in the soft palate. So we'll do a short number of breaths, 15 breaths, fairly slow. You don't have to be too forceful unless you're really a pranayama expert. You can do it at your own pace. And then I'll give you the signal. We'll hold the breath for a count of four and then slowly exhale. So we'll start. Hold. Exhale. And then we'll do it again and just see if you can, during the hold, I'm going to suggest a slightly longer kumbhaka hold in the middle of between the inhalation and exhalation. And just keep your attention on the soft palate, which is the seat of the Talu Chakra. And we'll begin. One more time. So this time, during the hold, the breath hold, see if you can keep your awareness focused in the soft palate and even feel your attention moving up into the center of the head, to the place of the Ajna Chakra. Again, now the inhalation. exhale, keeping your awareness now in the soft palate and the ajna, the center of the head. So now we'll do another slight variation on this. Inhale. Now, we're not going to do the pumping motion, just a long, slow inhale focused on the soft palate. Exhale focused on the soft palate. Now with the next inhalation, feel the breath flowing in, touching the soft palate, and then rising to the center of the head to the Ajna Chakra. And with your focus on the Ajna, inhale and exhale. We'll do one more inhalation, focused in the soft palate, then rising to the Ajna. Exhale with the feeling that you're expanding the center of the head. And allow your awareness now to be present in the center of the head, in the Ajna. Inhaling and exhaling. Letting each breath flow in as though into the soft palate and then up into the Ajna. And let the exhalation expand through the Ajna, as if you're opening up the space of the head. If there's a sense of pressure, expand your awareness so that you feel as though the space of the head is as large as it needs to be. In other words, allow your sense of the prana to expand past the borders of your skull. Each breath flows in and touches the soft palate and flows up to the Ajna. And the exhalation creates a sense of expansion there. Chant three Oms. And then we'll chant Om Namah Shivaya Gurave and begin our Q&A. Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Again, welcome. Deb is going to call on everybody and unmute you when she sees your hand. So,
hi, Deb. And you can raise your hand by pressing star 2. So I've gone ahead and muted someone that might be in the New Jersey area. If you raised your hand.
That would be Camus.
Okay.
Hi, Camus.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Before I ask my question, I just wanted to say this class is a lifeline, and I am so grateful. It couldn't have been timed better. But my question is about memory. The Sutra 111 says, memory is not being completely disconnected from objects of previous experience.
Yes.
And that implies, of course, that I should be disconnected. And my kind of story is that I have a memory that's like a combined blessing and curse, because it's really good. It's really accurate. It's practically photographic. And it serves me really well in a lot of situations. And unfortunately, it's karmic pattern seems to want to remember more things that I don't want to remember than things that I do want to remember. And so my question is just like you say in your meditation book that just committed meditation over time can help defang some of the dark memories, like, because I find myself when I get triggered and these feelings of violation come up, it just sets me up to accuse something or someone. It's like I feel like my life is being threatened and I want to deflect it in some way. But then I don't have any active protocol for dealing with that. And I was just wondering, like, is it better to just kind of let the Shakti take care of it over time, or is there something more active that I can do to balance this energy?
Thomas, this is a great question, and it goes right to the heart of the practice. So two things. The definition of memory in book one actually has to do with the kind of vrittis that come up. So in other words, some of our vrittis, some of the immediate thoughts that we have are responses to experience, either the result of accurate perception or accurate understanding or of false perception or understanding. Memories are vrittis, thoughts, that are not connected to the present experience and tend to be more connected to our samskaras. So essentially, the human system, the human brain, processes everything. And if the charged events, the negatively charged events, are not dealt with immediately, which they usually aren't throughout most of our life, they become lodged in our system as samskaras, and which we've talked about earlier. So this tendency, which many neuroscientists have noticed that we just tend to hang on more to negative memories and thought forms than to positive ones. There's a book called Buddha's Brain that came out about 10 years ago that some of you may have read. It's got a wonderful line in it. It says, our brains are Velcro for negativity and Teflon for positivity. So your experience is not unusual. Let me just say that. So the Yoga Sutra have a method for dealing with the samskaras that you would like to move away from in the moment. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about it in the next class. It's called Pratipaksha Bhavana. It is actually practicing, deliberately practicing an opposing thought. So, for example, and you have to choose the opposing thought carefully, because there are, there are different ways to oppose a negative experience. For example, if it's a, this person said something horrible to me and I was deeply hurt, which is a normal negative samskara that we would tend to return to. There's a few ways you can deal with this. One of them, which I have actually found rather useful, though it's somewhat elaborate, is to make the thought into an object. So in other words, look at the thought in your mind, as it were. I mean, obviously you're not using your physical eyes, but regard the thought in your mind. Regard it as though it was an object and not something that you are automatically buying into. And just notice the feeling around the thought. And at that point, you can do something that, you know, I sometimes teach, which is to imagine a fist coming down and smashing the thought, literally clenching the thought. Imagine a feather coming and sort of sweeping the thought away. So you would, in other words, what you're doing at this point is dealing with the thought as an object, an energetic object inside your mind field. That would be, that's one way to do it. And it actually, and then just be aware of the space that remains when the thought is gone. And you may have to do it a few times. But what this does is it changes your relationship to that particular type of thought. Because part of really the important lesson that we get from working directly with thoughts is, first of all, it takes away our tendency to identify with every thought and opinion that comes through. And it also reveals to you that you have a creative power in your mind to put thoughts in and take thoughts away. And then the thing is, you then need to find out through experience, if you want to do the practice of the opposite. And again, we're going to talk about this at some length. You have to find a thought that actually liberates the negative thought. And it might be, if the thought is something like, I mess up everything, I'm not good at relationships, you would tell yourself, well, these are all, some of the ways in which I am competent. These are some of the lovely things that people have told me about the way I am in a relationship. In other words, you would actually talk back to yourself by reminding yourself of an opposite experience.
Mm-hmm.
The deeper way to work with it, I honestly find, is to remind yourself that your real nature is consciousness, that you are a being of light, and that this thought is simply arising. The thing about giving yourself an opposite thought, I'm a bad person, I'm a good person, is that it only works sometimes. But the process of reminding yourself of your true nature actually tunes you into that aspect of your being that knows your fundamental goodness your fundamental beauty. And so when working with a thought like that, you are actually training yourself to look past what your mind says. And at some point, perhaps today, you realize what goes on in my mind are simply vrittis that arise and subside. Some of them are connected to deep-rooted patterns that I've been holding on to ever since I can remember. But that doesn't make them any more real or any more true. So the practices for just reminding yourself that you actually can practice with thoughts as energies, as ideas that are coming and going, and being willing to be vigilant about it, not to allow the negative thought pattern or the resentment or whatever it is to stay there, but to actually notice it and send it on. And, the Vipassana practice of going, okay, anger arising, resentment arising, nasty memory arising. Every time you do that, every time you label a thought like that, it defangs the thought. But it's just that you have to do it. You have to catch it. You have to catch it, yeah. So thank you for that question.
Thank you for everything.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank you. Okay. Deb?
Sorry, we have turned my mute off. We have a question that came in before the class. Charles asks, he seems to have a lifelong obstacle in that whenever he undertakes a discipline, he does a great job and he loves it, but he'll get sick of it or hurt in a way that completely stops the momentum and rarely seems to resume the discipline after the healing. So no matter how carefully he plans or prepares, it just always seems to happen. Is there a way to stop that pattern before the sickness or hurt occurs?
Wow. I know what you mean. This is not at all uncommon. Here's what I would say, and I don't, without knowing the specifics, are you on the call, Charles? Because if you are on the call, I'd like to ask you if you're talking about a physical hurt or something else. I mean, are you talking about a physical hurt that, for instance, makes it difficult for you to do asana practice or makes it difficult for you to sit? Are you talking about a disease that, actually causes you to not be able to sit up? One of the things that I've noticed, I've seen it in myself, is that whenever I start a new practice, there's always going to be a period where obstacles that appear to be absolutely real obstacles start to come up. And I'm specifically thinking about physical practice. The first time I started to do a serious yoga practice, I sprained my ankle and, just could not do standing postures for a while. And what I had to do was actually make up my mind that I was going to find a way around it and to begin to find workarounds. So I would say the number one way of dealing with an obstacle that comes up physically is to really seriously consider what a workaround would be and actually work with it, find a way to work with it. Because what really matters with yogic discipline is that you have one. So if there is a problem that makes it hard for you to do a full-on practice, what would be a halfway practice? What would be a shorter practice? What would be a less demanding practice? What most matters is that you keep a thread of connection to the practice. And for myself and for most of the people I know, the most important thing that I have found in my own practice is that I have protocols for when I have, say, an hour to sit. I have protocols for when I have half an hour to sit. I have protocols for when I have 10 minutes to sit. And if I'm really sick or injured, I do the short one. I do the half hour one. If I'm you know, too sick to sit up, I do the 10-minute one. And what I have discovered is, and I think this is true for many of you, if you feel like you just do not have the physical or mental stamina to do your entire practice, if you just decide I'm going to do it for 10 minutes, what will often happen is that the inner opening, the inner expansion that we cultivate over time begins to kick in, and the practice starts to expand on its own. But at some point, with any discipline, you have to make up, you have to do what, I'm going to be sort of hardcore about this, you have to make a promise to yourself that for X number of days or X number of weeks, you know, in some traditions they say that when you're learning a discipline, you should do it for 40 straight days for the same amount of time every day. And that really works. 21 days will do it as well. But you actually make a promise to yourself. You make a vow to yourself. I'm going to do this practice every day for X amount of time, or for between X and X amount of time. This is my minimum. I will not do it, no matter how I feel. And once you get into the habit of making those vows, those practice promises, then you start to realize that you do have the ability to keep up a discipline. And if there comes a point where you're bored with a particular way you're doing that practice, find a variation, find an alternative to it, or get creative with it. You know, perhaps, again, if I knew exactly what you were talking about, I could give you more specific directions. Find a different place to practice. Find a different time to practice. But make sure you do it. And in that way, the habit of self-discipline becomes a samskara that will nudge you and nag you when you forget it. And that's when discipline really begins to take hold. So thank you for that question. It's one I think that many people have. And I've found over the years that in the end, there's no way to trick yourself. You just have to say, this is important to me. I'm going to do it. Thank you.
Kristen asked, and I think this kind of goes in line with what you were just explaining to Charles. She said that in your last class, you said that it was important to have a practice that is pleasurable or produces contentment. And she'd love to hear more about that, how to cultivate a practice.
Well, my method, my personal method, and it's one I recommend, is that you experiment. You know, so we've been doing a series of practices in this class. We started out with the vertical breathing from the heart to the Ajna. And we did, you know, we've also been exploring this Tana Chakra, Ajna Chakra, breath and holding practice. And the last class, the last two classes, really focusing in the heart. So, of course, there are many different ways that you can cultivate pleasure in a practice. For many people, meditating in the heart, meditating in the lotus of the heart, meditating with the breath in the heart, meditating with a mantra in the heart or a visual image begins to open up one of the qualities of the heart center, which is that there is a natural sense of pleasure that begins to arise when you're meditating in the heart. The same thing is true for many people with a mantra. But it's also true that often when we first begin a particular practice, it's hard. You know, when you're meditating in the heart and your heart center is dense or dull or the energy feels hard, you often have to just be with it for a while in order to soften the barriers, soften the armoring that's around the heart. And in my book, Meditation for the Love of It, I've given a whole series of ways in which you can cultivate for instance, let's talk about the heart center, that you can cultivate it by feeling the caress of the breath coming into the heart, feeling it as a sensual experience. You can do the same thing if you're focusing on breathing the nostrils and then feeling the breath coming up through the soft palate and the Ajna chakra. You can actually let yourself feel the physical sensation, the subtle physical sensation of the breath, so that your meditation becomes a meditation on the sensuality of your natural breathing process. You can use a bhavana, you know, a thought. I offer this breath or I offer this mantra to the being within me. You can use a visualization. You can use a word like trust or love. In other words, to cultivate pleasure in a practice, it's very helpful to find a combination of the sensual, the kinesthetic, that is the energetic feeling sense, combined with an emotional component, a bhava, an attitude, which can be something like, I honor my heart, or I honor the inner wisdom that arises within me when I pay attention. Or, you know, simply find a phrase that allows you to cultivate a positive feeling, a feeling of love within the practice. And the for me, in general, the two methods, the two almost fail-safe practices that allow me to enjoy pretty much any practice is, first of all, connecting it to the breath and connecting it to the touch of the breath. You know, breath has a quality of touch, especially when you first begin it. And in time, as the breath expands, as you get deeper into a meditation with the breath, the prana within the breath, the subtle life force within the breath, will begin to expand. And then if you allow yourself to feel the expansion, you know, sometimes it feels as though a very subtle balloon is blowing up inside your heart or blowing up inside your head. And allow yourself to follow that expansion, feel into the edges of the expansion, so that your cultivation in the practice is one of actually exploring the edges of the experience or exploring the center of the experience, so that every aspect of the practice becomes an experiment, becomes an exploration. Very often, you know, we're meditating and we have this feeling of meditating on an object, and somehow we keep the object far away from us. And this is when a practice becomes boring or difficult. So what you always want to do with the object of meditation is little by little have the intention to open it up and create more and more of a connection between you as the meditator and the object of meditation, which could feel like as though you were moving your sense of self into the object, or that you're opening up your consciousness. In other words, you're realizing that your awareness includes the object. This is all very subtle, but it really is in the subtlety that we start to experience the pleasure in the practice. In other words, it's not just something you're doing in order to experience a particular result. It is an experiment that you're doing within your own body. And what will start to happen as you practice with this understanding is that suggestions will start to arise from the innate intuition, the prajna, the underlying wisdom of your own consciousness. And you'll be guided, you'll be directed. And that kind of direction is not the same as as getting an idea, oh, maybe I'm practicing with the breath, maybe it would be better if I practiced with the mantra. It's not necessarily a mind-borne instruction. It's a kind of an intuitive instruction isn't necessarily the word, though sometimes it does come as an instruction. It's a kind of intuitive movement that occurs. So, you know, many of the notes, the posts that we've been getting on the listserv are examples of people who have found an intuitive expansion or experimental practice arising in the course of meditation. And that, you know, when you're practicing with that awareness, that intention, to feel where the practice is taking you, to see where the practice is taking you, to hear where the practice is taking you, because, you know, we all receive intuition through different inner senses. But the more you can awaken your inner senses, and the more you can be interested in what your inner senses are telling you, the more interesting and enjoyable the practice will be, and the more pleasurable it becomes. So thank you for that question.
I'm unmuting someone, maybe a Jessica in Los Angeles.
Hi.
You raised your hand.
Yes.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Sally, I love the Yoga Sutras. I'm so happy that you chose this text for right now. I have two, like, process questions. The first is the invocation to Shiva that we've been using. It has become like the most loving pet that is following around and constantly wants attention, and it's wonderful. And so I've been using it as my main mantra. Is that okay?
Of course. Okay. Is it? Are you doing the whole mantra?
The whole thing.
I mean,
I'm singing it
go
all
to
the
time. Touches, I don't know what, oh, wow. So when you say it's your main mantra, does that mean you're walking around with it, or are you doing it in meditation, or both?
Both.
Okay, that's fine. As long as the mantra doesn't feel too long in meditation, there's no reason why you shouldn't do it, and there's no reason why you shouldn't let it chant itself internally. If you need a shorter mantra, which will often happen, then, you know, then Om Namah Shivaya is the short version of the mantra. So yes, do it. Go for it.
Yeah.
Let us
and
know what happens.
Yeah, that's been the main mantra I've been working with for years. But this Fogler one, it just wants to be sung all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's an exquisitely devotional mantra.
Great.
You know, it's really called, yeah.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
And so the second question is, I have found that reading the text, reading the commentary, reading your contemplation is giving me, I'm finding it a richer experience than my meditation practice right now. And it's, I'm getting kind of waves of Shakti and feeling my identity fall away with more ease than in meditation. And I'm wondering how to best work with that so that I can pull that energy more into my meditations. And I'm wondering, should I do my text-based study? I've been doing it before I meditate, but maybe I should be doing it after. Any thoughts about that?
Well, here's what I would say. If you meditate first, then you'll go into your text study with the meditative state, you know, and it will enhance your text study. But if you do it first, which, you know, my experience with reading a text, especially a text that's as psychoactive as this one, before meditation, it actually kindles a deeper feeling in the meditation. So I recommend doing it before meditation. I think it's a very, very skillful and beautiful way of practicing. The thing is, what you might consider doing is stopping in the middle of the reading and just meditating, contemplating, holding the words that particularly strike you, letting yourself expand the feeling that's coming up as you read it. Noticing if your identification with the body is dropping away, just let yourself sit with what remains so that you incorporate meditative moments into your text study. And, you know, I like you, I find that these texts, for years, they've really been the basis of enormous transformation. So if you have the ability and you have the kind of intellectual and emotional makeup that responds to words, then it makes a lot of sense that reading would expand your consciousness very directly. And I don't think it's a problem, but if you can find meditative moments inside your reading, it will, first of all, enhance the reading. And maybe you're already doing that, but it'll enhance the reading. And it'll make you feel less of a gap between the practice of text study and the practice of meditation. So I hope that helps. And I fully encourage you to focus on the reading. It is profoundly transformative to actually study a text. And it's very helpful when there's an accessible commentary.
commentary is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's really great. I know.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Okay, we've got somebody that's in Virginia.
Ah, wonderful. Well, first, I just want to express my gratitude. I've been a lurker in the listserv. I haven't really spoken up, but oh my goodness, it's just like looking in a mirror in many, many ways. And I've blown away blocks that were impeding me for years. And
fantastic.
Absolutely wonderful. And it's really, I feel, Sally, like you're in my head, because the things that I am experiencing that are a little different than what you describe, I experience them, and then in the next breath you put words to them. It's quite amazing. So thank you.
You're so welcome.
Thank you. The question that I have is about the breath, concentrating on the soft palate. And I'm wondering, is this similar to a breath called Brahmari, where there's a vibration that produces like a bee buzzing sound?
That's a really interesting question. You could definitely do it as a Brahmari practice, which I assume you know how to do, right? I mean, you could do that. You could do that vibrating bee sound with focus on the soft palate, and it would probably activate the chakra even more specifically than the breath we're doing. So many of the pranayamas that focus in the head are really intended to open these two chakras, the talu and the ajna, which are actually one chakra, or at least they've become one chakra as they open. I would play with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but
they're different. They're different practices, but they have, as you notice, if you've done different types of pranayama, many of them can be applied to different centers, and many pranayamas have a similar or allied effect. And that Brahmari practice is really, really strong for opening the head centers.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And I hope
you're
that
so welcome.
In August, that, you know, by then we'll be able to carry on with the retreat at Kripala.
Oh, you know what? I just got a note from them saying they're staying closed, which I'm very sad about. And they're going to get back to us about how on their platform doing some Zoom classes and maybe even a Zoom retreat, that's we're discussing it. I know it's not the same, certainly not the same for me, but at least there's a way. So anyway, I hope I'll see you in the next Yoga Sutra class in June. And thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm planning to. Thank you
for sharing this with you.
Okay, we have a question from the webcast. Person asks, what is the spiritual significance of the pandemic that we are suffering through, and what are your guides saying?
Oh, wow. I think about this a lot, and I there are many, there are several different ways to look at it, and one is that it's, you know, it's an inevitable result of the situations that we find ourselves in as a society. In other words, with mass travel, with human cities and houses being built in wild lands, you know, with the movement of people through so many different streams of countries and cultures and so much plane travel, that it is a kind of inevitability, a physical inevitability, part of this moment when it seems as though the existential threat of the destruction of the human race, you know, is becoming something that more and more of us have to consider. So I have friends who are teachers who take a very dramatic view of the pandemic and wildfires and the various earth changes. They see them as signs that the goddess, the earth goddess, the Mother Nature, goddess Kali, people describe her in different ways, is, you know, giving us a big wake-up call. You have to behave differently. You have to treat the earth differently. You have to treat each other differently. I don't see it in that dramatic a way, but I do believe it is a huge wake-up call, and that it's, my hope is that it will inspire us to treat each other better. And, you know, I have my own particular, as many of you do, understandings about what would make this world a better place for more people, including things like universal health care and, you know, and other social welfare practices. Not everybody agrees with that. So I would say part of the spiritual significance of it is that it is inviting us to really look at our responsibility for other humans, for animals, for the physical planet. You know, it is a huge wake-up call in that sense. From another point of view, I, as those of you who've studied with me over the years probably know, I deeply feel that the prospect of the possibility of imminent death, the actual, you know, events that make you look at the fragility of life, are tremendously significant for our spiritual life. Because truly speaking, if we realize that we do not have infinite time, either as an individual or even as a society, as I think it was Samuel Johnson, you know, the great 18th century English writer, I think he said, the thought that you'll be hanged at dawn concentrates your mind wonderfully, wonderfully. The thought, a man's thought that he will be hanged at dawn concentrates his mind wonderfully. And, you know, in so many traditions, you're taught to meditate in cremation grounds, in cultures where they have cremation grounds, to meditate in graveyards, to really contemplate the fact that life is finite, and to ask yourself, what am I going to do with this life I have now? I would say that that is the primary spiritual significance of the pandemic, aside from what it's teaching us about the ways in which we actually need to wake up as a society and learn how to be better stewards of our human family, of our animal family, of the earth herself. That would be my answer to that question. And, you know, there's so many factors, there's so many things going on now, including the damage to the information ecosystem. There's, you know, so much confusion and distrust about what's true. That's certainly happening in the United States. That, you know, it is also inviting us to really examine our understanding about truth, about information, about where we get our information, to actually ask questions like, is what I see and believe is true actually true? Always a good idea, you know, just questioning reality. And, you know, the fact that the pandemic is giving rise to so many conspiracy theories, so much partisan opposition, again, in the United States, really should be asking us to look at what are our priorities in terms of the way we receive information, the way we spread information, the way we handle information, the way we, the decisions we make about our own health. In a certain sense, every one of us is being asked to, you know, to deeply question the way we live, the way we eat, the way we interact with people, the things that give us joy and create meaning, and to examine these and start to make decisions that really take us closer and closer to our own heart and, you know, take us as much as possible in modern life off the treadmill into a space where we are living according to what our true priorities are. So that would be a partial answer to this question, and it is a very, very big question. What is the pandemic teaching us? I would say, first of all, to take care of ourselves, to take care of others. Secondly, to question. And third, to remember that life is infinitely precious and that we don't have infinite time either to awaken ourselves and also to become real stewards of our planet and of our society. So, again, thank you for that question.
All right. I just unmuted someone that might be in North Carolina. If you raised your hand.
Hi, this is Gail.
Hi, Gail.
As you were talking, I was just feeling how grateful I am in some ways because the pandemic has really let me get quieter and let so much fall away that was, I feel like, distracting me. And so for that, I'm very grateful. My question, and certainly having your class right now is just so beneficial. Two questions, really. One is, in studying about the attachments and everything, I realized that in living by myself, the thing I miss the most is probably touch, you know, just being hugged by someone. And I was kind of just wondering if that's like an attachment or if it's actually a human need that we have, you know, as just human beings to be touched.
Well, I do think that it's a human need. What makes something that we value, such as touch or human interactions of different kinds, or beauty, or, you know, delicious tastes, the experiences of the senses, you know, these are part of the joy of being on the planet, right? You know, being in a body. Your skin loves to be touched in the right way. You know, your nostrils love fragrance, beautiful fragrance. What makes it an attachment is when you feel you can't live without it. When you cling to it past the point where it's actually beneficial. So, and, you know, and that question of when you let go of, for instance, living by yourself and in this lockdown and nobody's, you know, there's no one living in the house who you could naturally hug. That's, you know, it's painful, you know, it's lonely. And many, many people are, many, many people are experiencing that. And yet, as a yogini, Gail, you can miss it and, you know, and also provide some touch for yourself, which is what I've sometimes done at times when I was you know, by myself or not in a situation where touch from someone else is appropriate. I would just sometimes use my own hands, you know, to feel human touch, and that's not deeply unsatisfying, or to experience the touch of the breath. And you know, you have a lot of meditation, I would say expertise, a lot of chops in meditation. So that, you know, we can, when we have a lot of spiritual practice under our belt, we know ways of working around the feelings of sensory deprivation. And that doesn't mean that sensory experience is, you know, sensory experience is part of why we're in these bodies. So it is sad not to be touched, not to be hugged. And as the question is, how can you use what you know about the body and your own capacities to make up for that in a time when, you know, when we're, many of us are alone.
Mm.
So
thank you
for that.
Yeah.
I would just experiment with it. Give yourself
a
hug.
Thank you. I will. And I have to say, I have my dog Gracie. So there's that too. So, you know.
Yes.
Other thing, if it's okay to ask one more thing, I was thinking about the ego and kind of that the second one about asmita and
yes.
And it just is like it's so tricky, you know, to me at least, because I can go for years without being aware of something that's my ego, you know? And just recently a friend, I was saying something about seeing the, going into an operation and seeing the sitters sitting there and knowing that they were going to be there with me. And he said, are you attached to the seeing, the city, and or are you just experiencing the feeling of them being with you? And I realized I was attached to the city. I was attached to the fact that I could see. And it's like it just kind of, I don't know, blew me away that it was like, and you didn't even see this, you know, you didn't even see that this was something you were attached to. And then it's like, well, how many other things am I attached to that I can't even see, you know? And I was wondering if you have a way of working with the ego, with helping us to catch, you know, what it is that we're attached to that we don't even see, you know?
Well, I think the question in the question here is, do you identify yourself as a person who is able to sense the presence of great beings around you? I mean, is this part of the self-description that makes you feel good about yourself? And, you know, and that's where it's the identification that is ego, not the enjoyment of the experience. And of course we're attached to joyful experiences and expansion experiences. The real test or the real issue is, can you be content if they're not there?
Mm, yeah.
You know, and that's where the work is. It's in, you know, actually being able to enter those moments which are not pleasurable and hold some kind of balance in them and not feel as though your entire identity is at question. Well, actually, I take that back. You know, there are times when it's very helpful to allow your identity to be called into question. You know, I mean, if your identity is as a spiritual person, as a meditator, as a person with strong connections to grace, okay, so what happens if you aren't that? Who are you if you're not that? And in a hardcore Vedanta, you know, or in fact even the tradition that the Yoga Sutra comes from, when you ask yourself, who am I if I'm not a spiritual seeker? And you just tune into the space that arises at the end of that question, you'll be in an egoless state. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do. Who am I?
So
if I'm not.
Yeah. So that's the way. I mean, that's the most direct way there is to work with the various identifications that come up. You know, when you recognize, okay, I'm defining myself by this capacity. I'm defining myself by this friendship. I'm defining myself by this connection. I'm defining myself by, you know, this particular form of expertise or, you know, whatever it is. You ask yourself, okay, who would I be if I didn't have that, if I wasn't that? And what often comes up is fear. You know, some of us have underlying depression and various, you know, our spiritual practice or other aspects of our life are part of what keeps us feeling okay, keeps us out of fear or out of depression. So when you look at what happens when you let it go and then let go of what's underneath that and let go of what's underneath that, eventually you come to the place where you're just in being. You know, and self-questioning is the great classic way of kind of allowing the aggregate of self-definitions that we all hold to fall away for a minute so that you can just feel yourself as being. You know, that's what will start to give you a degree of attachment from the self-identifying aspect of Asmita. So thank you for that question.
Thank you. That really helped. Thank you.
Deb?
All right. We have another question from the webcast. Karen asks, I have a question about the heart center practice. I am noticing that there is a difference between being in the heart space and opening, expanding, and also feeling the emotional content that is more personal. Right now, it's hard to discern what is the sort of pain from being in touch with the world pain and personal pain and letting it go into the greater love and expansion. Is there a way to move past the personal pain, even if it's connected to the world, and move into the greater space with more ease and more as an offering?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And, you know, because a lot of us being empathic are actually experiencing the collective pain and being very impacted by it. And of course, the more personal pain we may carry, the more the collective pain triggers us. You know, as we were speaking earlier about memory, that it's very helpful, first of all, to actually be able to consciously hold space for your own pain. And I'm going to give you a practice that I found very helpful. It's a kind of a shamanic practice, which works with a space of compassion that is in the wider area of the heart. It's in the subtle body, but outside the physical body. And it helps trigger a kind of compassion that can be also become self-compassion and can be a way of holding the pain that you're experiencing for others and for yourself without falling into the swamp of, you know, of sadness, grief, etc. And, you know, the way you do this is you place the side of your right hand with the side of the index finger against the sternum, and then you place the side of your left index finger next to the pinky finger so that you're actually creating a space of 8 finger widths from the heart. And, you know, I think many of you have done this measuring practice when we do the heart-based Hamsa practice. So that space 8 fingers distance from the sternum. If you bring your awareness there, focus your awareness there. Imagine that as a circle around your body. And with your attention in that space, in that place, outside, you know, 8 fingers outside your body, breathing into it and breathing out of it, you hold the situation, including the heavy feeling that we often get when we're feeling afraid for the world or afraid for ourselves or feeling the sorrow that others are experiencing. You hold that sorrow at the very edge of the space that you've created around your heart. And what this does is it triggers compassion that is not based on emotion. You're actually holding the emotion inside the space of compassion. I would try that. It will have the effect of removing the kind of personal identification that makes it so hard to handle collective pain. And also, of course, it makes it hard to handle your pain. The other thing that I recommend, which is not for everybody, but I've found it very helpful, and many of you do it, which is the practice of Tonglen. And I have a particular way of practicing Tonglen, which is not traditional, where you imagine, starting with yourself, you imagine yourself, your suffering self, sitting in front of you. You inhale the experience of pain, of sorrow, of anger, of grief, whatever it is. You inhale it into your heart and offer it to the presence behind your body, which I call the great heart, or which we could call the goddess, or which we could call the deity. Creating a sense of presence behind your heart, a sense of the presence of goddess, the presence of the higher self, presence of Shiva, or simply a sense of a universal spaciousness in which anything and everything can be held. And imagining yourself as you were doing with the enlightened self practice last week. So inhale the sorrow through your heart and offer it into the presence behind you. And then exhale, feeling that the presence behind you is sending love, healing, light, peace, joy, harmony, back through your heart into the suffering self. And then you can bring in a person who you feel particularly connected to who's in pain. Or you can bring in, you know, the thought of people in a hospital in New York City. You can bring in anyone or anything that, you know, you want to specifically become present to and, in a certain sense, cultivate a healing attitude towards. And you can breathe that suffering into the heart, into the great heart behind you, and then breathe love and healing back. Many of you know this practice, and it's a profound practice. I like to do it with the feeling that I'm connecting to a greater being rather than believing that I need to process it in my own heart. Partly because it's been my experience that that greater being whom we can become present to through this practice is not different from us, but holds the abilities, the skills, the wisdom, the love that we may not have access to personally at this moment. And when we do this practice with the great being behind us, then we become more and more used to being a vehicle, being a vessel for this kind of universal love and compassion. And one of my early experiences with this practice, which I've shared with many of you, is that you start to recognize that the sorrow you feel, the anger you feel, the grief you feel, the jealousy you feel, whatever the emotions are, the feeling of unworthiness, the feeling of, you know, frustration because there's nothing you can do about a situation, that these are not personal. They are universal feelings. And you can be, you can, in a certain sense, allow yourself to be a clearing house for them. You can create a clearing space by being willing to be present to them, breathing them in, letting the greater force of love and healing flow through you and into them. And people who get really good at this, you know, who are very advanced at this practice, say that it actually affects the people that you're doing it with, just as blessing and prayers affect others. But the main thing that it will do in terms of your personal practice, it will begin to clear these patterns and the ways of identifying with discomfort and pain, and it will actually make you more able to be compassionate without having your compassion turn into heartbreaking grief. So those are my suggestions, and honor your own empathy, not by keeping away from things that trigger it, but by working with it when it comes up, because of course it is a great gift to have that kind of empathy. And it's simply that we have to learn how to practice with our own empathy in a more object way.
Are you ready for another question?
Yes.
Okay. We've got someone that raised their hand. California, is that Dawn?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Dawn. You've been very patient.
Hi, Dawn. I didn't think you were going to get to my question, so I started moving away since I have two young daughters wanting to celebrate Mother's Day, but I really wanted to be on the call. It's just... But what a...
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. I am so enjoying this class. It's such a wonderful experience to be able to go deep and have the time. It reminds me of the experience I had with the Spandakarikas. I was really able to do the practices deeply, and there's just been so many profound, incredible moments. So thank you so much. And
thank you so
much. Question. Yeah, it's been so lovely. And I wanted to, about the Om Namah Shivaya, I just wanted to share that I've been practicing Ashtanga now for about a year and a half and going to the beach before this class started. And before the class started, I started to chant Om Namah Shivaya. And the full chant, but I couldn't remember the last two lines, so I started humming it. And I just hummed it. I didn't know why. And then he started the class with Om Namah Shivaya, which was because I'd only chanted with you once before at Madonna. And I just couldn't believe it was just this moment. You know, you have those moments of awe, and like, I was looking at the horizon of the beach, and it just came to me. And it was like I was saying it louder and louder, and I didn't know why. And then you started the class with this chant, so it was very special. Yeah. So
thank
I'm
you.
And after class four, I had an experience, and you know how you talk about listening more deeply to the inner voice, you know, quieting the mind so much that you can allow that more wise inner voice show up spontaneously. And it came, it hasn't come in a long time, but it just very clearly said, I'm already dead. And I think it was more like a loss of identity, like self-identity, like this reality, the sense I had, it's more of a sensation, but the sense I had was that this reality is also death, that like this is also the dream state, or I don't know, it just seemed it's very hard, obviously hard to put into words, because it was a sensation that I experienced once those words came out. from a very deep meditation, and I just didn't know if you wanted to, you have been talking about death, and but in the sense that this reality is also about death, that we are already dead, like our, it's more of a soul, like a lifelong journey of our, you know, this reality is about our soul connection, that the soul keeps moving on. I don't know, but, or that I, that yes. part of me died when I came into this life, that maybe that I myself, I did. So I wanted to talk to you about that just a little bit, like there's this, maybe I'm still in this lifetime identifying with a past life, you know, and it felt like I let it go. I just, I've never had an experience like this. I thought I would ask. So thank you.
Well, yeah, it's a good question, and there could be many answers to it, but this is how I think it's perhaps most productive to look at it. You know, and this is a spiritual bhavana. You know, just to have the idea, okay, I'm already dead. It's actually as a sannyasin, as a, you know, when I took the vows of sannyas, when I became a swami, one of the things we do as when we take initiation, we perform our own funeral rites. So you actually die to the self that you've identified with. And of course, when you're taking sannyas, it's a ritual. It's not that it necessarily gives you a full-on experience of that. But the idea of it is that if you consider that you're already dead, then what happens is that you automatically let go of certain hopes, desires, and fears. You know, because in a certain way, the worst thing that could happen to us, or as we believe, we hold this idea, if you think about what's the worst thing that could happen, you know, if you lose all your money, what's the worst thing that could happen if you, you know, if you lose the people that you love most, the worst thing that could happen from a certain point of view is that you would die from it. And of course, many of us would say, well, there are things that are worse than dying. And I know I believe that myself. But there is something about realizing that you're actually already dead. In other words, you've been born and died countless times. And truthfully speaking, none of us have that many more years left. If you know, if you're very young, maybe you have 60 or 70 years left, or maybe 80, but you're going to be dead, at least in this body. So what is the freedom that comes if you say to yourself, I'm already dead? You know, and
yeah,
for me, yeah, so I would take it as that, you know, just like it, that's an invitation to go through your life with a feeling of freedom as though, you know, there's nothing left to lose.
Yeah, I think the pandemic brought that up, and it's like practicing non-attachment at a whole new level, but it came and it wasn't scary. That's the part. It was, I'm already dead. Yay.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
It was a freeing moment.
It is. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, thanks for that.
Dawn, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that.
And it's a great experience.